Our next speaker is going to speak to us about the steps forward. What has and is being done at academic institutions? We asked Dr. Sherry Wren to come speak to us. Dr. Wren personifies both diversity within gender issues, but also really incorporates diversity in a lot of different ways. She's currently the professor and vice chair of Stanford School of Medicine at the Department of Surgery, the director of global surgery at the Center of Global Health and Innovations, and the director of surgery at Palo Alto Veterans Hospital. Dr. Wren?
So thank you so much for the invitation. So first, that study of the GYNs, what's hysterical is the vast majority, that was actually put out there by gynecology oncologists who predominantly are men. So they're the ones who actually commissioned that because they knew they were getting underpaid. And I like to talk about diversity, and it's a diversity in many things. So when I stand up here, I'm visibly a woman. But nobody here knows that I'm actually the only college graduate in my family, and my grandmother's steel mill pension actually paid for my half of my medical school. So fortunately, I didn't have to graduate that much in depth. And I'm at a place like Stanford where having graduated from Loyola Medical School isn't the same degree of many others. So diversity, in many ways, is not just what we visibly can see, but there's many aspects to what diversity is. And I love what Caprice just talked about, because if you look at the quote I have, studying characteristics of behaviors of an individual, we need to stop that. We need to direct this now at the institutional culture. So what can we do? I think I'm not going to talk about this document, but we've recognized it. Dr. Mayer really put his president on the line last year for the ASA, and many of us in this room have contributed to this document. It's available free online. So I want to talk about and highlight some key issues, a lot of it for reflection, because I think once you have knowledge, you can drive change. And I want to show some successful strategies. I was tasked to actually do that within medicine. And I think if you just look at the headlines of everything you can see right now about diversity, parity, and inclusion, nobody has a winning hand on this now. So a few lessons that have come out of the business world. Men often don't stand up to speak about parity initiatives because of so-called lower psychological standing, meaning they don't have a dog in that fight. They don't believe it's their place to engage. And this is a critical problem. What's been shown, though, is if you can engage men in these discussions, their support actually grows through participation, and it becomes vital. It stops being a woman's problem, or an African-American's problem, or somebody's problem. Bottom line is, leaders, not our HR departments, have to own this. You've got to own the metrics. You've got to own the parity. The buck's got to stop with us. We have to start demanding better representation in our candidate pools and increasing the people being considered and embracing diversity in a wide aspect there. We also need to do a better job of, as we bring candidates in, do they see people that are like them within the institution? Because if not, why might they want, and they probably might not want to come. We have to look at elimination of unconscious biases through our hiring process, and we've all seen this a million times. It's the I want to have a beer with them test, and I mean, I've done the same thing, but we have to start being better at this, and we need to overall change our culture that people are going to feel more welcome. So this was a very interesting document that got put out by the AAMC, and when you look at this, and I'd like you to just begin to think about this, we are really into the word fit. How many of us have said that in our residency? They'd be a good fit at this institution. What does it actually mean? It means you prefer people like yourself. It would be horrible to get a room full of me. Like, there would be no air left in the room because I can out-talk anybody. This actually leads to both implicit and explicit biases, and the bottom line is a room full of me is not diverse, and you're going to get whatever it is that people like me think about. We want to embrace everybody. Confirmation bias. we will absolutely unconsciously seek out information to support my bias. Well, I really like Sharon Stein because, I mean, she's like me, but clearly she's really, really talented. So what does that do? Where do I see it? At a place like Stanford? We tend to favor in our selection criteria certain sets of universities over others. I was at Texas once, and I'm like, you know, we admitted somebody from the University of Arkansas. You know, I thought some of my faculty were going to stroke out. It's like, it's Arkansas, not Harvard. But that's a bias. Visible lack of diversity. So what do I mean by that? Think about everything that our universities publish, focus on, have pictures of, and if it basically shows what I, no offense, Ron, call OWGs, a bunch of old white guys, that's what it shows. So these are unintentional communications from the leadership on high of what's being valued. If success stories only ever focus on male success, well, there are no women's successes then. Then there's this unconscious othering. And this really creates an us versus them mentality, which I really try to go away for. Because it's a black issue, or it's a woman's issue. It's not our whole community's issue. So you're turning it into something that it shouldn't be. This, I think, is pervasive sometimes. And it started, I think, in some ways with the quota system. Oh, we got to get one of those, right? And it's this perception that if you embrace diversity, you are compromising merit. And that is absolutely not true. I never wanted to be a quota in my life. I knew that I wanted to be hired because I am the best person for that job. And then we undervalue and overburden our diverse faculty. How many people in this room have been like the diversity representative on endless, endless committees? We get killed with this. And then our viewpoints are only solicited about diversity issues. Like, you can only be there to talk about that, but not about other academic issues. So these are things that we need to think about because they're part of the system that is impairing us from moving forward. So I'd like to start with recruitment strategies because who we bring in is critical. We must strive and achieve broad representation on our selection committees. We've got to avoid the one member representative of diversity. I can tell you firsthandedly, removing subjectivity in the process and creating objective structured interviews can have a massive impact. I ran our chair search for urology. We did structured interviews of all candidates, and it really allowed for a differentiation that the CVs perhaps had not. This, I think, is critical. It's your first meeting for search criteria. Define and commit to the specific qualifications and attributes before you review a CV, because now you have a schema in mind. A mind switch here. Who are we going to include as opposed to who are you going to exclude? It's a subtle shift, but it actually will make some changes. Bias training of your selection committees, actually, and making sure that they know that letters of recommendations and references are different when they're being written for men versus women. So people need to be educated. And this one, I have to say, I didn't know until I put this talk together, that there's actually data to show that if you rush the process, gender bias actually emerges. So making sure that you have ample time to do this work. So some other strategies, promote awareness. I think that coming from our leadership, we need to discuss evaluation bias as a first step. Pay attention to our own thoughts. Am I thinking this way just because something or whatever? And if I don't really like that person, well, is it something that I, you know, why? So be open. Actively recruit. Again, if I go out and just pick people that look like me, that's a problem. We need to seek candidates who are going to contribute to both diversity and excellence, and we need to ask our colleagues for top female and minority candidates because there are outstanding people out there, and we need to find them. I cannot stress more how helpful structured interviews are. Overall, it's fair. You set objective criteria. You can actually make a matrix of the attributes that you want and how are they responding to this. It's easy to learn how to do this. It's actually fairly easy to learn how to develop this. And this has become standard in many businesses. And I think this is an interesting thing. Don't rank the finalists. Actually focus on strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, it's like, give me your top. Well, actually, we have, you know, this is strengths and weaknesses, because who is going to fit best is going to be based on that. I think we have to proactively address some of these barriers to achievement. And, you know, Caprice has sort of talked about this, but we have to understand and work to avoid that women are less likely to be included in informal and social gatherings. I actually had a sit-down meeting with my dean once to ask if I should learn how to play golf. Because in the world of surgery, as we go to surgery meetings, golf is a common activity. Golf is much more likely to be played by men than women, and this is 4 to 6 hours out with senior leadership, hitting that little thing around the golf green, and you can't buy that kind of access. You could never get that access. So to have an entire conversation with my dean about learning how to play golf, and he basically is like, no, you do not need to play golf. But he wasn't a surgeon, so I'm not sure if that was the right decision. Women are less likely to be included in collaborative research. We're less likely to have mentors and sponsors, and less likely to be given advice about navigating the workspace. So we have to work to address this. Retention and promotion. So I tried to come up with a list that I thought are actually things we need to address, and that these are impediments to keeping women. So a number of years ago, Sabine Giraud, a colleague, and I interviewed and surveyed every person who had left Stanford, because we had basically heard that women leave to go into private practice, or, you know, they're going to be stay-at-home moms. And what we actually found is that women and men leave for exactly the same reasons, which is they feel unsupported or they get a better job, and an equal amount took academic jobs. So there was really no gender difference in this. But we actually found women left sooner than men. So I don't know if they saw the handwriting on the wall or whatever. Pay parity is a huge thing, especially as we hear about it more. People are just getting pissed off. A subtle thing that there is, I'm going to have a slide on this, but equity and departmental support. If you look at every single AAMC climate survey, women feel less supported. Now, that's nebulous. I don't know what less supported means. We need to put some teeth into what does less support mean. I think universally faculty are going to, especially junior faculty, say they don't understand promotion or compensation metrics, mentorship, sponsorship. We need to develop leaders within our own departments. This one, to me, came out in our survey with all of these people who left. This was all departments. Dysfunctional actors within the department. When these people are not shut down, it harms everybody. And people leave. If you've got a dysfunctional division chief or section chief or co-person, people end up leaving because they just don't want to deal with these people. I think Caprice talked about the family penalty, which women bear more than men. And then this lack of visibility. So there's been a number of analyses about invited grand round speakers and everything from around the country, how people are addressed, all these things. So we need to actually look at, in our meetings, everything. Do we actually have diverse representation? I can't tell you how many times over the last 20 years I heard a talk about diversity given by a man, and then the nominating committee stood up to give the slate. And you're sitting there, and it's like, short white guy, bald white guy, white guy with glasses. After this whole speech about diversity and how we're embracing it as a surgical society, and then the nomination slate just sort of slaps you upside the face and said, okay, this is just all talk. So we've got to change this. And then there's a perception of lack of inclusion, or people feeling included. So pay parity. This is a touchy subject, needless to say. Now, if you're at a public institution, you can look up everybody's salary online, believe it or not. If you're at a private institution, this gets a little different. So I think there has to be some discussion about transparency, certainly of the comp plan, of metrics. I think there has to be review of salaries by gender, URM status, RVUs, and indexing these to known metrics such as the AAMC. There should be mandatory review of outliers. So if you're less than the 30 percentile for AAMC in your department, boy, why is that? Somebody's got to review this. And we have to understand there are actually gender differences in negotiation. Caprice talked about how we supposedly get coaching and everything, but you've got to adjust for it. You can't just coach it away because this is the start of the pay gap. If you're coming in an assistant professor and earning $15,000 to $20,000 less than somebody else, it just explodes over time. So here's a best practice. Diane Farmer, who's the chair at UC Davis, when she's meeting with a new hire, regardless of gender, and they don't ask for that targeted salary she sort of has in mind based on the AAMC, and they ask for something else, she actually says to them, I think you meant X amount of money, and ups it for them, and literally says, this is what I think you meant. So this is firsthand how this can be addressed as we start. I'm not going to read you, but there is this whole Association of Women Surgeons gender equity statement recommendations. It's available online, and I think the college also adopted it. This is Dr. Chen's data, who's sitting right here, who actually looked at a salary assessment in his department. So they looked at it, they surveyed their faculty, they compared it to AAMC median range for specialty, gender, everything, because many more women are in breast surgery, so how do you value this? All this was done by the entire department. And what you can see here is that mean RVUs are actually not statistically different. And Herb, if I present your data wrong, just correct me, okay? They're not different. So this is the picture before they put in a new compensation plan. First, they actually surveyed people. Do you understand the compensation plan? And this, I would say, would be true in almost every department. You can see assistant professors are woefully ignorant of compensation plans. By the time you get to be a full professor, you're understanding it a bit better. And you can see here that in his department, this is percent of AAMC median compensation. Men are at 56%. Women were down at 26%, highly statistically significant. So what did they do? They put in a new comp plan. And after it, as you have already seen, women actually substantially increased from 26 to 42. Men went up 2 percentile. Now, they're still not equity, but I know that there's plans at UAB from your dean and everything to continue to be looking at this process. But Dr. Chen shouldn't be the only department that has this data. That's the bottom line. He shouldn't be the only person showing this data. Departmental support. Now, this is probably one of the most nebulous things, and how do you quantify it? So Dr. Mary Hahn, my own chair, and I are actually trying to figure out how to do this now. There is no validated survey for this. But I think we all need to look at how do you review the administrative, clinical, operative support normalized amongst faculty to clinic OR days. Because I can tell you that we have a male faculty member who has 3 times the support in the same clinic in the same building as we have a female faculty member. And we've got to figure that out. You also have to look at how do undesignated referral policies come in. Because sometimes they're being shunted to certain individuals, and it's not being done equitably. And I think it is incumbent upon us to look at this. And at the MIT Museum right here, they have this ruler. You can go see it. So there was a full professor at MIT, Nancy Hopkins, who she wanted to add 200 square feet to her lab, and she got turned down. So she just got mad. And she went and she took this tape measure around and measured lab space amongst professors at MIT like her and found out that men had labs that were 2 to 4 times larger than hers. And so this, we have to start looking at these and normalize them to level of support to begin to erase any type of inequity that exists. We need to do it because it's right, and we need to do it because it's fair. So faculty development and investment, mentorship and sponsorship is critical. You have to have mentors for both professional and personal issues. Nobody is ever going to come to talk to me about having children, but dogs, no problem, come and talk to me. But professional issues, we need to do this. We need to make sure that our faculty are getting mentored. Do they have sufficient mentorship? I am not a believer in mandatory mentor assignments. I don't think they work often. We need to have people who are going to sponsor women and diverse faculty for awards, panels, speakers. Don't just put up somebody who looks like you. There's many excellent programs and leadership training, and the AAMC has a lot of programs. We need to send people and pay for them to go to these programs. We need to have friendly, family-friendly policies. Meetings and conference times are often difficult. One of my male colleagues just had his third kid. He's not showing up for M&M. But he contributes in other ways. He goes to the IRB. He runs this. He runs that. So he's contributing, but he's not going to hit that metric of how many M&Ms can he hit, because he's got to actually take his kids around in the morning. So it actually is hitting both male and female faculty, but it does tend to hit the females more. I cannot stress the dysfunctional faculty issue more. Leadership must articulate expected behaviors. What is going to be tolerated and what is not? And then you've got to handle bad actors. Because if you come in and you say, we are not supporting a harassment environment, a bullying environment, but you have the bully in chief as a division chief, this is a problem because, again, there is no truth to that statement, and everybody knows it. And what happens? You're going to lose faculty because they don't want to work with that person. And I think this is from my own department, leadership opportunities. When we started looking at adding vice chairs and associate program directors, there was an open call out to the whole faculty and an application process and an internal search process. Within, because then the opportunities are getting spread out. People you don't know, maybe somebody wants that job. This is much more fair. Same thing for all of these directorships that happen in hospitals. We need to be more inclusive as putting out the word. So I'm going to show you just a little data. UC San Diego really took this on. So they had this enormous process that started back in 2004, salary surveys, climate surveys, demographics, reporting back to the family, to the faculty, changing, not calling it, I can't remember, they changed the name of it. It wasn't like women's like pregnancy leave policy, it became a family policy. They did this entire progress over many years with multiple iterations. And look at what happened. They were able to increase the amount of women faculty, tenure women faculty, and underrepresented minority faculty in a significant manner, all through periodic measurement of campus climate, combined with interventions that focused on improving faculty behavior, and they saw less complaints. So they've really been able to put this into practice at a school-wide level. There was a single paper written by the University of Pennsylvania. They have a similar process and what surgery was doing. I'm not going to share it. It's in JAKS. It just, the data isn't there yet. But people are beginning to do this. So I think that multifaceted diversity improves performance. It's been shown endlessly in the business literature, and that is truly multifaceted. Equity and inclusion are vital to sustaining our departments. Most importantly, our leadership can't just talk the talk. You got to walk the walk. Pay and resource equity is critical to this climate. You're going to have bad climate if people believe they're being treated unfairly. Set your performance metrics and report on them and have as much transparency in the process as possible. Thank you very much.